Outside Atlantic City's huge convention hall, the boardwalk temperature is barely over 30 degrees. On the inside, it'll be a comfortable or warming 60 degrees, where the Liberty Bowl game is played. Grass over concrete forms the playing surface. Grown under artificial light, the grass actually had to be cut, so that kickoff time finds the turf trim as can be.
And there was plenty of change by then, too. A good deal of it captured on film for newsreels in the theaters before football became a television staple. First of all, can we talk a little bit about how long it's been since we relied on newsreels? When did all those newsreels end?
Well, you know, newsreels, obviously when television became more prevalent in, you know, let's say the mid-50s into the 1960s, obviously newsreels started to play less and less of a role in providing visual news. And it's actually more complicated than that, too. It's not just, you know, that TV started to replace newsreels, but the whole Hollywood studio system was kind of breaking down, and this whole economic infrastructure that supported the production of you know, the cartoons that we all love.
Which in and of themselves didn't make a lot of money.
Exactly.
Right.
You know, they were there to kind of to round out the program. So you'd go to a film, you'd go to see Casablanca, and there would be a newsreel, there'd be a cartoon, there might be a 10-minute live-action feature, and then you would, or short. And then you would see the feature film. And for a number of reasons, which we don't really have time to get into, that economic structure started to break down in the late 40s and was, by the end of the 50s, was essentially gone. And so that's one reason why the newsreels started to disappear. So by, you know, basically by the 1960s into the 60s, the newsreels were not really a part of the program anymore.
A lot of the newsreels that you'll show people in your program on Friday night are special events, things like the first indoor bowl game, which is hilarious, you know, the grass, live grass grown with artificial light. on concrete, but a lot of it's just play calling. I mean, they're just like giving you the highlights, game highlights, and they're calling it the way they see it.
Yeah, I mean, you know that I've done a similar program called Rare Baseball Films for 10 years, and this is the first, well, kind of the second time we've done a program like this with football films, and you know, I certainly like to include important game footage, you know, whether it's of an important player or of a memorable game or, you know, things like that. But equally important and maybe more important to me are finding those films that either provide like an interesting lens on some other aspect of the culture or just like a really interesting connection, you know, where two parts of the culture kind of intersect, you know, on the playing field. And I like to provide both. You know, I know there are going to be some people that are coming just for the football part of it, and they want to see as much, you know, kind of historic game action as possible. So there's certainly plenty of that, but there's quite a bit more.
If you're just joining us, this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And my guest is Dave Phillippe, Director of Film and Video for the Wexner Center for the Arts. And you might be surprised to hear that we're talking about football this hour, where he is presenting a program on Friday. It's called Rare Football Films, the Newsreels. It's on Friday at the Mershon Auditorium. For more information, go to the link on our website at wosu.org/allsides. And Dave, we might as well talk a little bit about the event. It's not just a you talk about it, you know, in between the cuts. You also have some special guests that are going to be with you. It's like a tailgate op. There's a tailgate option.
Yeah, I should describe the whole program. So from 5:30 to 7:30, outside, kind of on the Wexner Center, Mershon Plaza, we'll be doing a tailgate party with the Alumni Association. The pep band's going to be there. And, you know, people can, I think it's maybe $5 more and you can attend the tailgate, but you do need a special ticket for that. Then at 7:30, the film program will begin. And throughout the program, if you've attended my baseball program, I get up a number of times throughout the program to just set some of the clips up because some don't need much explanation. Some need quite a bit. And then after that, two former Buckeyes and two players that played in the NFL, John Hicks and Bobby Carpenter, will be up on the stage doing a conversation. And we did this 2 years ago. We did a tribute to NFL Films when Ed Sable, the founder of NFL Films, was going into the Hall of Fame. We worked with the athletic department to kind of stage a tribute to him because he was an OSU graduate. And so we showed some NFL films, but then at the end, Eddie George and Jim Lachey came up on stage and had what I thought was just an absolutely fascinating conversation about, you know, their college career, their pro career, their transition from college to pro, their transition from, you know, player to retirement, essentially, at a relatively young age. And, you know, I think it was Jim Lachey that said when he was drafted by the San Diego Chargers, and when he got there, he was struck that basically everything that he had at Ohio State was better. You know, the equipment, the locker rooms, you know, just everything was of a higher quality at Ohio State. And I thought that was really funny. And Eddie had a great story about retirement. You know, I think I asked him, you know, when was the moment that you knew it was time? And he said, you know, he was in practice and he kind of looked up in the huddle, and everyone in the huddle was like the second and third stringers. And he was like, okay, this, you know, it's time. And so we're hoping to have a similar conversation with Bobby and John. I think it'll be interesting too, because they're from pretty different generations. And, you know, John played for Woody Hayes in the kind of one of the best eras of Ohio State football in the early 1970s. You know, for younger people especially, they might not realize John Hicks is one of the greatest players who ever played for Ohio State. He won the Outland Trophy, won the Lombardi Award. He finished second in the Heisman voting, which was unheard of back then for an offensive lineman. He played a position, you know, that if he was playing today and he was as good as he was, I mean, he would have been like a first or second round draft choice this year. The two highest draft choices, if I remember, were off the position he played, offensive tackle. And, you know, those guys get, you know, millions and millions and millions of dollars now if you're a good offensive tackle. So he, I'll have to ask him about that. He missed out.
Wrong era.
Bobby was one of the great, great linebackers who ever played at Ohio State. He was a first round draft choice by the Dallas Cowboys. And he has his own radio show on 97.1 The Fan. And just is, I think he really always has an interesting take on sports and on football. And he was one of the reasons I wanted, was interested in having him on the stage.
I'm sure there are people out there wondering, why is Dave Phillippe, you know, the director of film and video for the Wexner Center for the Arts, talking sports on All Sides with Dan Fisher today and talking about this program you're going to be giving on Friday night? What's the connection for you between what you do, what your job is, and these sports clips?
Yeah, that's really a good question. You know, I think on the simplest level, I'm very interested in sports. I'm actually more interested in baseball. But to bring those two interests together, baseball or football and film, is very rewarding to me. It's certainly a way to get people to the Wexner Center who might not normally come for, you know, a new documentary or a, you know, series of, you know, Truffaut films or something like that. This is a different way to expose them to what the type of program we do at the Wexner Center. But I think over the years, as I've been doing the baseball program and now this football program, I'm just always struck by what a interesting lens sports is for the broader culture. You know, watching, you know, just by now kind of hundreds of these historical films, you know, they always touch on politics, race, gender, different aspects of popular culture, and that's incredibly interesting. I mean, that's ultimately what's the most interesting thing to me. And I think that's why I'm interested in film, too, is like film, you know, just by its nature touches, you know, everything. And
these films, as far as I know, I mean, the oldest one is from 1910 or 1903.
1903.
Yeah, that's Princeton and Yale football game.
Yeah, so I think, if I remember it, Yale won 11-6. And
that's really weird that you know that.
Well, and it's, as far as I know, it's the first film of a football game
ever.
So that's 1903, and it's, you know, people will really be interested by it. And then what's funny? So that's from 1903. We have and then I have a clip from a 1935 New York Giants Bears game, and it's funny how, except for the passing, in a way, how little had changed.
I mean, it's kind of scrubby looking. Looks like they're playing in dirt.
Yeah, there are players in the Bears Giants game. This is the mid 1930s with no helmets on.
Right, right.
You know, and
the uniforms.
Yeah, they don't really stand out, and you can tell. You know, college football was kind of big from the get go, but it was certainly more of a regional or local fan base. And the NFL, pro football, really didn't take off until this kind of great marriage of football and television happened in the late 50s and 1960s. Whereas compared to baseball, you know, baseball has been, you know, quote unquote, the national pastime, you know, for over a century. And actually in doing my research too, that shows up in doing the research. There's much more baseball footage than there is football footage. Mm. And so that was kind of a thing I had to work through in putting this program together as well.
Brian in New Albany, you're on the air with Dave Phillippe of the Wexner Center for the Arts. Welcome, Brian.
Yes, hi, Dave. I just wanted to add a little comment. In the course of going to a local historian's presentation about early railroads in Central Ohio, I found out something kind of interesting, which was really something I've been wondering about a long time. I started going to Ohio State games in 1980 as a freshman. And of course, you know, at that age, you think you're pretty much inventing things or doing things for the first time. But as I got older, I was curious as to how long this tailgating tradition, even if it was not called that, had been going on. People coming down and, you know, partying or celebrating or whatever pregame, and you're basically making such a big deal out of the games. And the presenter who was doing this historical thing said that in their family it was talked about that their great grandfather had been killed on in an accident on one of the interurban trains, which were so common back then. And these interurban trains, they would go out, I mean, way outside of Columbus, way up to Prospect, Ohio, Marion, you know, pretty far flung. And apparently it was very, very common for the people out in the rural areas, the farmers and so forth, to take these interurban trains into Columbus on game day, you know, enjoy themselves, and after the game come home, I guess, very late at night. And when he was researching through the old newspapers, trying to find out more details about his great-grandfather, who had apparently fallen off of one of these interurban trains. They were, if you've ever seen them, they were kind of open designs, and people just sort of hung on to them. And he said he had a little difficult nailing it down because there were apparently quite a few of these accidents. I guess it was fairly common for people to fall off of these trains after an OSU football game on their way back home.
Because of the tailgating.
Yes. And this goes back, I think it was in the maybe late 1920s or something. And so that's, I could sort of begin to kind of recreate it in my own mind that apparently, these college football games, I'm sure this is not, you know, unique to Columbus, these college football games were very, very big deals, and much of the same type of environment that it was, that it is now, was apparently going on even back then, I'm sure, you know, to a smaller scale, but I just found that interesting. It shed a little bit of light on how things were, you know, 80, 90 years ago.
So yeah.
That was my only comment.
Well, thank you, Brian.
Yeah, that's great. I had never heard that before.
It kind of buttresses the idea of the college, the popularity of college football over professional.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And, you know, just coincidentally, I was watching for work, believe it or not, some Three Stooges shorts.
Dave's got the life.
Exactly. And there was one called Three Little Pigskins. And so it's from, you know, maybe I think the late 30s. And, you know, one of the main plot points is that these gamblers mistake the Stooges for these, you know, great college football players, and they're trying to, you know, bribe them to throw the game for them. And kind of going back to my point about how college football has always been so much more interesting than pro football, you go back in, you know, films in, you know, the 40s, 30s, 20s, perhaps even into the teens, you know, college football's often, you know, Harold Lloyd's film, The Freshman. There's a film adaptation of James Thurber's play, The Male Animal, which, it, you know, kind of theoretically takes place at Ohio State. And that's from 1941, I think. And the whole backdrop of the play and the film is this, you know, big game weekend at this, you know, unnamed university that, you know, everyone kind of recognizes as Ohio State, and they're getting ready to play Michigan. You know, so, yeah, college football was incredible. You know, it was actually, you know, people, some of the great players of the 20s, Red Grange, Bronco Nagurski, you know, it was really a step down when they were done playing college football and went and played NFL football, you know. And I think, you know, maybe the football historian you have coming on next could address this better, but you know, as much as we read in the newspaper today about, you know, breaking NCAA rules and getting payments and stuff, that stuff went on maybe much, much more
to a
higher degree back, because there was less, it was harder to catch, you know, there wasn't Twitter, there wasn't Facebook, it was harder to catch people back then. So like the caller said, you know, this stuff's been going on for longer than we probably suspect.
My guest is Dave Phillippe, director of film and video for the Wexner Center for the Arts. We're talking about Rare Football Films. It's a program he will present on Friday. For more information, go to the link at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Dan Fisher. We're considering the history of football, college football, pro football today with Dave Phillippe, director of film and video for the Wexner Center for the Arts. He's presenting a program on Friday. It's called Rare Football Films, the Newsreels. If you want more information about that, go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Joining us now, Andrew Doyle. He's a professor of history at Winthrop University. Professor Doyle, they don't say where Winthrop is. It's in the South, though, right?
It is. It's in South Carolina. It's in Rock Hill, South Carolina, Charlotte metro area.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining us today. We appreciate it. Your specialty is sports and football, right?
That is my research specialty. I teach all kinds of U.S. history, but that's what I've written on and done research in.
So maybe you can jump in on the conversation we were having before we took the break on whatever, you know, why pro football had such a rough start compared to college football, which seems to take off pretty quickly at one point.
Pro football was non-existent. I mean, college football was created really in its American form in the 1880s. And it was played by college students and designed very specifically as a game of the elite, because this was an era when only 2% or so of Americans went to college. So it was only rich kids who went to school. And they created the game very consciously to try to separate it from the mass sports of baseball and boxing. You know, those were games for the lower classes. Mm. And so we need a game for rich guys like us. So they created football as a way of, you know, they had this complex ideology around it of how it was going to train the next generation of business and government leaders and all of this. And so there was really no space in the media narrative and in the basically ideological presumptions that grew up around football to try to, you know, bring in a professional game. So by the time there were semi-pro games, but they were not amateur. They were not quote-unquote pure. So the media castigated them, generally speaking, ignored them, and where they really got traction was in working-class communities in the Midwest, which is why you see the NFL get its beginnings as factory-sponsored teams by, you know, basically the employees of the factory and whoever else they could hire just to come out and play for $100 on a Sunday. So the class and, of course, ethnicity and religion, it was mostly the new wave second generation immigrants. And just about all of them were Catholic. So that in the mind of a mostly Protestant America, and in the view of the dominant media, this was working class. It was disreputable. They took money for playing, and they were Catholics as well. Which
it's just kind of like the whole ball of wax, right?
In
one game there,
absolutely.
Professional football. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We're talking about the history of football by way of newsreels, and let's check out another one. In 1959, The brand new American Football League founder, Lamar Hunt, made an important announcement.
The president of the American Football League, who has a very interesting announcement to make, Mr. Lamar Hunt of Dallas, Texas.
Thank you, Harry. It's with a great deal of pleasure that here in Chicago today that we, as a group, the American Football League, are announcing our commissioner, Joe Foss, the governor of South Dakota.
Thank you, Lamar. It's with a great deal of pleasure that I appear here to announce the fact that I am the commissioner of the American Football League.
And it's with a great deal of pleasure, Dave Phillippe, that I turn to you. So now 1959 comes along, and things are getting kind of legit. We've got the governor of a state being named commissioner of a new league.
Yeah, and that's, you know, perhaps one of the reasons why they selected him for an extra level of legitimacy. One of the reasons I wanted to include that clip in the program, of course, is Lamar Hunt does have a great deal of importance to the sports scene in Columbus. He was the first owner of the Columbus Crew, mm-hmm. and so I thought people, you know, I'm sure most people, you know, are aware of his connection to his, you know, incredibly important connection to pro football. But just in case there were people that, you know, maybe only knew him as the owner of the Columbus Crew, I wanted to include that clip as well.
So what kind of turning point, Andrew Doyle, was the AFL? The NFL had been around a while, but now they have two leagues.
Absolutely. The NFL was really, really stuck in its ways. They had a proven formula, and that was to stay basically East Coast and Midwest, and they didn't expand to where the population was moving in the Sun Belt. Lamar Hunt, of course, from Dallas, the Hunt oil fortune, and Dallas was a booming city, and it needed a football team, and it was, you know, as we all know, an extremely profitable football team. They love football in Texas, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
And the NFL wouldn't go there. So places like, you know, Minneapolis and Dallas and Houston and, you know, the places in the South, Atlanta, that really wanted NFL franchises but couldn't get them. So Lamar Hunt started the AFL basically to start his own club because the NFL wouldn't let him in theirs. And so then the NFL tried to freeze him out. They created the Cowboys, forced the Texans to Kansas City, Hunt's team, which led to antitrust action, which led to Pete Rozelle putting in the fix and then the merger. And so, you know, Pete Rozelle is one of the greatest, probably the greatest sports commissioner in history, because the NFL rose from kind of big in the 1950s to the behemoth, the $11, $12 billion a year behemoth it is today.
Something Andy might be able to address more, too. At this almost exact same time, baseball's antitrust status was really under examination. So, you know, you would see baseball executives and even players testifying before Congress about, you know, the effect that baseball's monopoly had on competition. And as kind of a result of that new focus, you saw expansion. You know, saw the New York Mets. You saw eventually a team in Houston. You saw franchises moving, like from Washington to Minnesota. And I don't know if Andy could, address if there was a link between the two.
Yeah, absolutely. Baseball has a much more ironclad antitrust exemption. Actually, football does not have one.
Mm-hmm.
And they've had to go negotiate it. And Congress can extract a pound of flesh from football every time they want some sort of clearance around antitrust laws. That's actually how the New Orleans Saints came into existence in the NFL. New Orleans is like the 50th largest media market, and they were way down on the expansion list, except that the guys who needed to clear them in Congress, the head of the Senate Judiciary Committee was Russell Long, senator from Louisiana, and Hale Boggs was the House Majority Whip when the Speaker was kind of senile. So he pretty much ran things in the House. So Pete Rozelle, basically, Hale Boggs extracted an absolute ironclad promise from Pete Rozelle. You will get an expansion franchise in New Orleans. And Rozelle is like, yes, sir.
Another example of sports and politics intersecting.
I know, but in baseball, they love Congress is not going to, in my, you know, vain attempts to predict the future. They're always wrong, but Congress has no intention or desire, and never has, to my knowledge, to actually revoke baseball's antitrust clearance because it gives them leverage. They call them before Congress. They call them before a committee. They rake them over the coals the way they did over PEDs.
Mm-hmm. Makes good TV.
Just a few years ago, it makes good TV. It's grandstanding. And then they can extract whatever political concession they want, and then everybody goes on about their way, and baseball keeps its absolutely, I don't know how many billions of dollars that antitrust exemption is worth, mm-hmm. but it's worth quite a bit.
Let's take a call from Ed in Baltimore. You're on the air with Dave Phillippe from the Wexner Center for the Arts, and also Andy Doyle teaches history at Winthrop University in South Carolina. Welcome.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. The comment about the Three Stooges movie with the gamblers reminded me of an old John Wayne film, which I can't remember the title of.
I think it's
where
called...
Where he was hired to coach a small Catholic college.
Right.
And brought in ringers.
That's
and
right.
They ended up traveling all around the country and getting very big and powerful until the faculty found out about it. And more or less demoted the program, and he thought he was going to lose his job because he'd bounced around a lot, and they said, no, we still want you to stay and coach, but we're going to trim back everything. And I, like I said, I thought it was a very good movie and really addressed a lot of the things that go on in college football, but well before it was really to the forefront that it is now. And I'll hang up and listen off the air.
All right. Thank you, Ed.
I think that film is called, it's something pretty simple, like The Coach or the Football Coach or The College Coach, something like that. And actually, bringing in ringers to a college football program is another thing that pops up in film, you know, in the first half of the last century. The Marx Brothers film Horse Feathers, that's another plot point where they're trying to bring in ringers to win a big game. And again, I would defer to Andy on this, but I think one thing that's really changed so much now is, you know, there's always been a level of corruption and kind of under the table things that have been happened in college sports, but now the money that's involved is so exponentially higher that this line they're trying to straddle between giving this impression of, you know, college sports, amateurism, you know, that they're student athletes and things like that. When at the same time, it's essentially some of these, you know, like Ohio State and all these big football programs are all but, you know, on the level of a professional franchise. And it's really, and there's no one wants to give up all of the billions of dollars that are on the table or mess around with that at the least. And that's, I think, one thing that's really changed, you know, say from 50 years ago. You know, when money was certainly involved, but I think it was much more localized. You know, you're trying to please your fan base, maybe your board of trustees, the local fans. It wasn't such a national issue.
No, you're dead on. You're dead on. It's actually been going on since the 1880s. Not quite since the beginning, but within a few years, as soon as football got big enough. There was enough money and enough prestige, enough institutional prestige. And so, you know, and you're absolutely right about the money increasing, and that's television. It was much more localized. Bear Bryant, hey, I'm biased. I grew up in Alabama, but the arguably the greatest coach who ever lived made $110,000 a year from the university in the mid-70s. But this was when the NCAA had a cartel on college football games on TV. And they didn't extract full revenue from it for a variety of reasons. And so once everything broke open and then once cable began and you have multiple bidders, so you have a limited supply of football and multiple bidders for the different contracts and prices have skyrocketed. The DVR era has just made it even more so, because sports are the one thing on television that is DVR proof.
You know, as a Michigan State graduate, I started there in the 70s when Michigan State went on academic probation for many years and they were banned from television.
Oh, yeah.
And people wonder, well, how bad could it be? Well, they're still coming back.
Yeah, for a variety of reasons. No, I mean, it's bad for a variety of reasons.
It was very, very destructive to be kept from television because there was no other way to get out there.
Which is why they're not going to do it anymore, because they are so boxed in by their quote-unquote partners, the corporate sponsors and the TV networks, and they use that word advisedly, and they really are partners. And the TV networks I don't know what they're going to do with Johnny Manziel, but something tells me they're going to sweep it under the rug the same way they did with all the Cam Newton stuff. Cam Newton allegedly got paid $250,000 or something to play for Auburn, and the NCAA just very conveniently forgot about it. How much money did college football, the SEC, and Auburn in particular make behind that national championship season with Newton being as absolutely brilliant as he was? I mean, it's in the eight figures.
Oh, yeah.
We are talking about the history of football by way of rare football film footage that we have and will be shown Friday at Mershon Auditorium. With me, Dave Phillippe, he's director of film and video for the Wexner Center for the Arts. He'll be bringing you that program. Also, Andy Doyle teaches history at Winthrop University in South Carolina. Let's leave this segment with a newsreel. At the first AFL game, the American Football League lasted 9 years before merging with the NFL. Here's a clip from the first AFL game in 1960.
Premiere showing for the brand new American Football League. At the Polo Grounds, the arm of Dick Jamison gets the New York Titans going. Don Maynard is carrying the ball deep into the territory of the Buffalo Bills.
All right, so at the Polo Grounds. When we return, we'll continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. We are talking about the history of football, college football, professional football, with Dave Phillippe, director of film and video for the Wexner Center for the Arts, and also Andy Doyle by phone from South Carolina. He teaches history at Winthrop University there. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Dave Phillippe will be presenting a program. It's called Rare Football Films at the Mershon on Friday. For more information, you can go to a link at our website at wosu.org/allsides. I have a list of describing clips that you're going to be going over at the program, Dave, and obviously we can't get to all of them, and some of them are silent films, so we couldn't use them anyway. But could you kind of give us a little overview of what sort of things people would see?
Sure. Basically the films cover the span from, we already talked about the Yale-Princeton game 1903, and then the most recent clip I have is from a 1975 game between the Vikings and the Bears, and I just included that because I am a Vikings fan. But, you know,
sometimes it's just that simple.
That's the luxury I
okay.
have. Some of my favorite clips are, there's a very simple one, and it's one that doesn't have sound on it, but it shows Jackie Robinson and his teammate Kenny Washington warming up for a game against, they played for UCLA, playing against USC. And everyone, you know, of course, knows Jackie Robinson from breaking the color barrier with the Brooklyn Dodgers. You know, this clip is from 1939, so that's 8 years before he broke the major league color barrier. And again, it's just, to me, it's one of those, entry points? Like, you know, hopefully a person would get curious, you know, why is Jackie Robinson able to play, you know, for a major college football program, and yet, you know, in major league, you know, he wasn't able to play professional baseball for 8 more years. And there are a lot of reasons. But, you know, hopefully it gets people, you know, what about that? You know, and that's, again, one of the reasons I like doing the program, is just to, you know, find those little kind of odd intersections of history.
That we might not still, you know, I was going to ask you about what sort of, what kind of archives are out there? These, now, this comes from UCLA, most of it?
Right. Well, with the baseball program, I've done it for 10 years. The first 8 years pretty much came exclusively from the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. And then the last 2 years have been from UCLA. UCLA is one of the world's great film archives, not just newsreels, but, you know, every type of film. They really work. They provide a lot of service for the Hollywood studios. But they do have this incredible newsreel archive. And they've been great to work with. And, you know, if you think about newsreels, you know, they kind of document, you know, the first, you know, more than half of the last century. And so it has provided, you know, it has proved to be this, you know, very rich vein of visual history, not, you know, obviously not just for sports. You know, I think when most people think of the newsreel, they think of World War II.
Right,
because
exactly.
That's, you know, up until a certain point, that was the most documented, visually documented event in human history. And but, you know, the newsreels covered everything.
When they did the play-by-play newsreels of football games, and I suppose baseball or whatever, and they showed them in the theaters, do people get into them as if they were watching the game, or do they just passively sit and watch because they already knew the score?
Well, I can't speak from experience,
do
but, you know, actually, that's a really good question. You know, because, and it's not like, you know, you knew the score of the Alabama-Auburn game on Saturday and you went to the theater on Sunday and watched. You know, there'd be days in between,
right.
You know, if not a week, you know, when this news appeared on the screen. So I think just the novelty of being able to see, you know, these players and teams that you would only be able to read about in the newspaper or hear about on the radio, there was a level of novelty to it. And you know, and if, especially like if you're in Columbus and you're a big college football fan, you might read, you know, that USC is great or that Alabama is great or back in the day that Fordham is great. But you never would really be able to see anything about the team except maybe a black and white picture in the newspaper. And so, you know, I think that probably was a big part of the attraction.
Andy Doyle, in that last clip that we heard, they were talking about the first AFL game in 1960 from the Polo Grounds. I mean, and in a lot of these clips that we see in this collection, they look pretty scrubby. I mean, football doesn't look too flashy for a long time.
It was not a big money game at all. I mean, there was, you can see it, the stadiums are not remotely as fancy as they are today. And the fields are often very interesting because, you know, we see elegantly manicured landscaping on all professional sports fields. And if there's any flaw, then we're highly critical. Back then, they tore the fields up in, I don't know, by October. And by later on in the season, they were basically, you know, ranged from just hard packed dirt or a sea of mud if it had rained.
And then, of course, they played in the snow back in the olden days, too.
Well, and they would paint the dirt green sometimes, too, to make it look good on TV.
Mike and Hilliard, you're on the air. Welcome, Mike.
Thank you, Ann. Dave, now when the AFL first started in 1960, in the West, was it San Diego, Oakland, Kansas City, and Denver, with Houston in the East, with Buffalo, Boston, and New York? And did Miami and Cincinnati join at the same time?
I think that might be a question for Andy, but I think you have it exactly right.
Andy Doyle?
Actually, Miami and Cincinnati joined at the time of the merger. They joined in 1969. They joined the AFL, but that was actually, the merger officially took place in 67. So that was a part of that.
Okay, well then let's turn to my a clip here. When the AFL and the NFL merged, they formed instead leagues with separate regular seasons and playoff schedules, culminating in a national playoff game.
Football has hardly seen anything to match it, and it's no mere flight of fancy. For behind the added attractions, there's a meeting of the outstanding play-for-pay gridiron greats in the Super Bowl at Los Angeles. For the first time, the champions of the NFL and the AFL battle it out to see who is tops in professional football.
Wow. I mean, they were hyping that stuff from the beginning. No wonder the Super Bowl is such a big deal now.
Well, it's funny. I mean, the first Super Bowl didn't sell out. I think there's a really great ESPN film, I think it is, or maybe it's HBO, about that first Super Bowl and how, you know, inexpensive tickets were. And Max McGee, the wide receiver that was named the MVP of the game, was basically hungover. He wasn't necessarily a star on the team. And he ended up having, you know, one of the best games of his life. So, quite a bit has changed since that first Super Bowl.
Andy, did that bring you back?
Oh, absolutely. they couldn't give away all the tickets to the game. And Max McGee was 35, I think, was long, long, long past his prime and had stayed out all night, by his account, with two women. And showed up the next day completely hungover and did not expect to play. And then Lombardi put him in, and he played the key role, that great juggling catch you've seen on the film.
About when did the Super Bowl take on the status that we know it by now?
You know, it got really big really fast, and this is the marketing genius of the NFL, the way that the NFL very adeptly used television. Boxing and baseball were the most popular sports in America in the 1950s. College football was third, the NFL was fourth, and at least in the early 50s. And baseball stayed in place. Baseball, you know, it was basically very poor ownership, very poor leadership from the commissioner's office. And the NFL owners had always had an underdog's mentality. And they had a series of excellent commissioners, Joe Carr, Burt Bell, Pete Rozelle, and the three of them, and Rozelle in particular, Rozelle took advantage of the skyrocketing demand for sports, and especially televised sports, in the 1960s and 70s. Innovations, Monday Night Football. I mean, it was a mantra among sports and television executives. You cannot have sports in prime time. There is no way. There is a limited market for sports. You have to go with primetime dramas and sitcoms. If you put sports on in prime time, your career will be over in television. And ABC was the laggard third network, and actually most NFL owners didn't want to do it because that's what the conventional wisdom said. And Rozelle pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed. And Art Modell was actually one of the owners who was most strongly with him. Lamar Hunt was another. And so they got, you know, they put NFL on in prime time, and of course we know where that's gone.
And that was ABC.
That was ABC.
And that pretty much, did that help make ABC as a sports network too?
Absolutely. Rune Arledge was, well, the greatest sports executive in history. He invented modern sports coverage because prior to Rune Arledge, it was just basically put on the game, have a radio announcer, and, you know, just don't try to do anything different. Just basically have radio with pictures. And don't do anything innovative. Don't push the envelope technologically or stylistically in the way that you present games. And Rune Arledge absolutely reinvented television sports, and then all the other networks played catch up with it.
I still miss that visual, the agony and the ecstasy visual.
Yeah.
From
and what they did with the Olympics.
Give to see those, yeah.
Down the
oh, yeah, and what they did with the Olympics back in the day when you could just hear about it from all around the world. I mean, it was so much richer to me.
Well, in ABC, for a long period of time, they were the exclusive, you know, carriers of the Olympics.
So, yeah.
And he, like Andy's saying, Rune Arledge was behind all of that. So.
Football, when did football people, you know, I guess there were the Newt Rockneys and that kind of a thing, but when did they start to actually have football stars? Do any of those emerge in the film that you'll show tomorrow night?
Yeah, certainly. We don't really have a Red Grange clip. But, I mean, Red Grange, you know, people talk about like a handful of sports personalities in the 1920s that were, you know, kind of nationwide stars. Babe Ruth.
Jack Dempsey.
Jack Dempsey. I'm blanking on the tennis player. I'm trying to think of Bill Tilden. You know, and, you know, Red Grange was in that handful of people that was viewed as, you know, kind of someone that transcended the sport. And, you know, there have always been big, you know, another thing that there was a brief period of time where the studios would make these biopics, essentially, of big stars. There was one, Bruce Smith was a Heisman Trophy winner for the University of Minnesota. Tom Harmon was a Heisman Trophy winner for Michigan. And Columbia Pictures made biopics of both of them with themselves playing themselves. And they're pretty bad films, but, you know, that just kind of goes to show you, you know, what place college football had Yeah, exactly. They sold.
A friend of mine has done research on movies, feature films, and newsreels in the 1920s and 30s, mm-hmm. Michael Oriard, and he's written four excellent books on the history of football in America. And he quantified, he said that, that there were on average five feature football films per year between, I think it was the mid-20s and World War II. Mm-hmm. And that in the late 30s, that football took up, by his approximation, 30% of the time of newsreels that during football season.
Wow. See, I grew up with Brian's song, and that was about it. You know? Before we move on, and we only have a few minutes left. Anyways, Andy Doyle, you mentioned when the AFL formed, they wanted to get a team down in Dallas. Dallas is a big city, big football. Texas is a big football state. Is it that dearth of professional and college football in Texas, or at least professional football, that made the high school football system in Texas such a huge force of nature?
Absolutely. And this is one of the concepts that Major League Baseball, you know, really was the only professional team sport going for so long. And so that if you weren't in the circuit, basically from Boston to St. Louis and Chicago, if you weren't in that, basically the industrial belt of the United States, so if you're in the South or the Midwest, the Mountain West, outside of the industrial belt, or the West Coast, then you had no quote-unquote major league franchise. Well, college football stepped up and filled this void very quickly. In my own research specialty in Southern football, the South didn't get professional, you know, major league sports until the Colt 45s, who became the Astros, and then the Atlanta Braves. So during this whole 80-year period before that happened, or 70-year period, college football was the only, quote-unquote, major league sport in the South. So that is what people really focused on. And then actually high school sports, it was more of a top-down thing. It went to colleges first and then filtered down into the public schools, in part because in a lot of states, the South in particular, there were actually were not public high schools to speak of, no high school system to speak of prior to the turn of the 20th century.
Andy Doyle, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Andrew Doyle, he's a professor of history at Winthrop University in South Carolina. Also with us, Dave Phillippe. He's director of film and video for the Wexner Center for the Arts. Thanks, Dave, for joining us again, as always.
Thanks for having me.
Dave will be presenting Rare Football Films, the newsreels, on Friday at the Mershon Auditorium. For more information, go to the link on our website at wosu.org/allsides. There's tailgate options and whatnot to choose from, so check that out. I want to thank the All Sides staffed this week. Producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, who has done an incredible job directing the show while Amy has been away. Thank you so much, Rachel Quimby, for all of your wonderful work. Production assistants Kiram Shaban, Leticia Wiggins, Andrew Zistler, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of Ohio State University.